As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to The Big Thing on Total Soccer Show, the weekly podcast where we sink our teeth into one of the bigger trending topics of the beautiful game. Today, we're talking about a club who've proportionately dominated The Big Thing since its inception, Chelsea Football Club. We want to know what has gone wrong for Graham Potter. Since Potter took charge on September 8th, as we record, we're recording before the game with Fulham, Chelsea have won four league games, they've lost four and drawn three. They've exited the FA Cup and the League Cup in their respective opening games in those contests, and as we record, they sit 10th in the Premier League. Graham Potter said this week he has the hardest job in soccer at Chelsea. A quote from him: "This club was run a certain way for 20 years and run really well. I have a lot of respect for the previous ownership and what they achieved. Unfortunately, they're not here anymore and you've lost all that leadership. Everything has changed pretty quickly. We have to build things up again." Pew, pew. Shots fired from Graham Potter. "It's not my fault," says Graham Potter.
Unfortunately was an interesting word in there as well.
Yeah, very, very a lot to read into that. Perhaps we'll get into that one later. But Chelsea do have an injury crisis right now with the likes of Raheem Sterling, Christian Pulisic, N'Golo Kante, Ben Chilwell, Reece James, many others on the sidelines. While players like Jorginho arguably are in a downturn of form. So, is it injuries? Is it a changing of the guard of ownership? Or is there more to the situation at Chelsea right now? My name's Ryan Bailey. Joining me today to discuss this, we have Mr. Taylor Rockwell. Hello, Taylor.
Hello.
And Graham Ruthven. Just heard his voice. Say another thing, Graham.
Hi.
There it is. Well, where should we start with this one, Graham? Graham Potter, your fellow Graham, may not have been expecting to be in this position when he took this role, having left Brighton for it.
Yeah, so I think the biggest disappointment, and Ryan, you did a good job of outlining what has gone wrong for Chelsea since he took over. They were in poor form before the World Cup. At the time, I thought that break had come at a good point for Potter. He'd be able to use that time in the training pitch to steady things. But since then, Chelsea have played four games and they've won just one of them. And as you say, they have a game tonight at the time of recording against Fulham. Even if they win that match, the big picture will remain the same, that things are pretty troubling for them at the moment. And the biggest disappointment of the Potter era so far, and obviously it's still very early days, but still, the biggest disappointment is that Chelsea are still showing all the issues they were showing in the first couple of months of the season under Thomas Tuchel. They don't look very dangerous in the attacking third. Sterling is the only player to have scored in back-to-back games for Chelsea this season, and that happened early in the season. And when you watch Chelsea at the moment on the ball, it's all very slow and ponderous. Not much happens quickly. There's very little fluidity. And part of that might be down to how it's a rotating cast of attackers in that team at the moment due to injuries and other factors. So nobody's getting many reps together. But nonetheless, that is a key feature of their game right now. Not a good one. And then defensively, Chelsea keep playing this high line that opponents are finding easy to expose. And if we compare two games, in my research today, I went back and I looked at the worst game that Chelsea had played under Tuchel, which I think was the Dinamo Zagreb game in the Champions League, the game that got him sacked effectively. And then maybe the worst game I've seen Chelsea play under Potter so far was a game they didn't lose, but they drew 1-1 against Nottingham Forest, and I thought they were lucky to get a 1-1 draw in that game. I went back and I compared those two games, and there's very similar things in those two performances. Chelsea had a giant talent advantage over both teams in both of those matches, but they were picked apart in the same way. And Zagreb and Forest both had this outlet of just popping a ball into the channels and using their pace in behind. In Zagreb, it was Orsic who did the damage. And then against Forest, it was Brennan Johnson. And their defence looked terrible. Koulibaly was all over the place in both matches. Chelsea were all over the place in both matches. And by the final 10 minutes, it felt like Chelsea were hanging on for dear life in those games. So Potter has been unable to solve any of the problems he inherited from Tuchel. And from that, you get a question. Is Potter just too similar to Tuchel to find the answers to these problems? Because there's a lot of overlap between those two coaches. Or is this something that is inherent with this group of players that Chelsea have at the moment?
So Taylor, my first question for you is, how does this Potter team look? How different is it to the Tuchel team? Has there been much evolution, or is devolution the opposite of evolution?
Yes. I mean, I think Graham like summarized it well. It's basically a lot of the same issues seem to be like making themselves apparent. And I think to understand what's not working, I did a lot of reading into what did work for Graham Potter with Brighton, with like Ostersunds, I forget where he was, like starting out, but with some of his other club experiences. And I think my thesis statement would be that Graham Potter wants his teams to have tactical and formational flexibility. He requires his players to reflect that in their ability. That means he basically doesn't want specialists who do one thing really well and play one style of soccer really, really well. If I wanted to extend it further, he doesn't usually play a 4-4-2 anymore. I think that's what he did when he started out. But that 4-4-2 has to have one striker who can then become that sort of other midfielder. So if you want to crowd the central midfield, that player can drop in and be that sort of attacking midfielder who can also do a defensive job. If you're playing a bunkered team, that 4-4-2 has to be able to come a 4-2-4 and then still have like overlapping fullbacks who can get involved in the attack. But it has to be the same personnel. And so it requires really flexible players who do a lot of things well, who can adapt to what's being asked of them very, very quickly. And then on top of that, he wants to then be able to tailor that flexibility, tailor that game plan to the opponents so that you're sort of limiting their strengths and capitalizing on their vulnerabilities. All of that requires a squad that has a lot of reps, a very clear understanding how to play, and then you can sort of have that like adaptation element as you then prepare for the individual opponent. None of that seems like a thing that's happening at Chelsea. I think he inherited a squad that had vulnerabilities in the actual structure of it. It's a squad that's composed of players brought in for, what, at least two, if not three, if not four different managers at points. And so you're getting a team that is sort of like haphazardly assembled. And I think that haphazard nature very much continues. But then you don't have strengths in certain areas. You mentioned N'Golo Kante being injured in the beginning, Ryan. I mean, I think that's a huge part of why Chelsea have struggled. They haven't had a midfielder who can kind of bring that balance and that dominance, and that's an area that they still haven't really rectified. They haven't had that number nine. Romelu Lukaku was supposed to be that when they brought him back. That didn't happen, and since then, they've signed a ton of attackers, but I don't think any of them are true out-and-out number nines. They all seem to do the sort of same thing of they want to be a second striker, they want to be a support striker, they want to play a little bit wider and then move inside. So I think the squad itself doesn't make a ton of sense in certain spots. But then I think on top of that, there's just not that cohesiveness that you might get with a full preseason, with a few more reps, with a few fewer players, basically. And so you kind of have this like bits and pieces assembled squad that doesn't have a clear understanding of how they're supposed to play. Then on top of that is getting specific instructions for the next opponent. And I think that's where you see so much chopping and changing, so many different people utilized in different games and utilized differently in different games. And I think it leads to a lot of head scratching across the board at Chelsea.
Yeah, a microcosm of all the problems that you just mentioned there, Taylor, with a lack of versatility and adaptability. I think you can find that in the midfield at the moment. So I said when Potter was appointed in September, I wanted to see what he would do with that Chelsea midfield, because that was an area of concern. And I think if you contrast how Brighton played in midfield and the personnel that Chelsea have, I think a lot of people saw that as a potential problem right from the get-go, that he didn't have the personnel to play in the same way that Brighton would. And so far, he hasn't been able to do very much because of that personnel. Injuries have been a factor there. So I think this season is probably going differently for Chelsea if N'Golo Kante is fully mm-hmm. fit and in form. He's the one player in that Chelsea midfield that you think could play Potter ball in terms of the counter-pressing and the ability to get close to opponents. So he might make a big difference if he comes back this season. I'm not exactly clear on how serious his injury is, actually. But even still, the profile of this Chelsea midfield is very different to the profile of the Brighton midfield that he had. At Brighton, he had two-way players like Caicedo and Alexis McAllister and Yves Bissouma before that, who would just offer so much on both sides of the ball. And Chelsea don't have that, and that has had a ripple effect throughout the whole team. Potter does have a weakness as a coach, even going back to his Brighton days. We used to say that Brighton team didn't score a lot of goals. And so that was something Chelsea fans maybe expected from him as Chelsea manager, was this team isn't going to score 3 and 4 goals in a game very often. So you still have that weakness, but you're the way that Chelsea's squad is built right now, you're not getting the strength of Potter. So at the moment, he's being made to look very bad because you're getting only the downsides. And all coaches do have their weaknesses, and that's a big one for Potter. That's all that Chelsea fans are seeing right now. They're not seeing any of the strengths because I don't think that squad is constructed to allow him to do that.
Graham, a question that I keep kind of coming back to is, like, Mark Cucurella, by like most accounts, by people who cover them, has not been a strong player this season. And that's a player who formerly played for Potter at Brighton. Now, Cucurella comes, then Potter comes. So it's not the age-old thing of the manager comes, he brings one player, and then somehow it doesn't work out. But in this case, I really struggle to understand. Like, that seems to me a strangely important thing to get our heads around, is like, why is this one player who has been very good for that same manager in the past now suddenly looks a shadow of himself before the manager comes, but then even after that manager comes? Do you have thoughts on what it is, or has he been that bad? Am I just reading the wrong reports?
No, he's been very bad, and I'm a fan of Mark Cucurella, even going back to his time in La Liga. I thought Barcelona were wrong to let him go. But if you look at where he was very successful at Brighton, it wasn't as a fullback, and that's kind of been where he's been playing for Chelsea recently. Has been in that back four where he's expected to get up and down. He doesn't have that mobility. He's actually quite slow, Mark Cucurella. And for Brighton, they had this wide left midfield hybrid position in that team. It's a wing back, I guess, but Mark Cucurella is also quite handy at coming inside, and we've mentioned the words versatility and adaptability for Brighton already. He was key to that, and this season Leandro Trossard has kind of been playing that position for Brighton. He is certainly not a fullback by any measure. So to have Cucurella going into a back four, I think that's the main reason why he's looked poor. That's not his position. It's kind of the Marcus Alonso paradigm, in that that's not his position either. But Potter clearly feels, due to personnel, that he can't play a back three at the moment. For example, he doesn't have Reece James to play on the right side. Mm-hmm. You would maybe say that Cucurella on the left and Reece James on the right would work. But Reece James is injured, so he's having to play Azpilicueta on the right side of the defence. He's not a wing-back, so he can't play him in that position. So everything points to a back four being the best solution for everyone else besides Mark Cucurella, and he's kind of the collateral damage of that decision at the moment. I think that explains why he's been so poor. Yeah. I wouldn't write him off so far, because I think once Potter gets all the personnel he wants in and he's allowed to construct that team in his own image, that's maybe when you can judge Cucurella.
First of all, thank you. That makes a lot of sense. It also, I think, helps me then better understand Chelsea from the metaphor of, like, putting your finger in the hole to stop the dam from collapsing, and then another hole spots up, and you have to, like, keep plugging, and as you unplug one, another hole opens up. And I think that's Chelsea in a nutshell for me. To your point, if you don't have Reece James, you can't have the two wingbacks, so now you have to put Cucurella in a spot where he's not going to shine. But if you were to force somebody to be a wingback, I think, like, briefly Christian Pulisic was utilized there just to see what could happen. Yeah. I think he's tried other people and it hasn't really worked. And then that makes the team worse. So then you go with a back four, but like Koulibaly and Thiago Silva, I don't think either one of them has shown particularly well this year. It does make me wonder if a back three would bring that like extra bit of stability. But again, you don't have wingbacks. And I think you just keep running into these problems of it's tough to find a way to get a starting 11 that makes sense, that is going to get the best out of the personnel involved. And so what I feel like we keep seeing is Graham Potter trying to make that happen, trying to figure out this starting 11 seems like it puts everybody in the best spot to get the best out of them. But now we need to get multiple reps out of them. And oh, no, in the second game, they had a really bad game and it didn't work. And in the third game, these two guys got injured. It just seems like things keep not clicking. And the longer they don't click, I think the angrier fans are going to get, and the more they're going to look at past coaches and past ownership and think maybe that wasn't so bad. Maybe that wasn't quite as wrong.
And the ironic thing is that in terms of the players that have been injured, you're looking at a lot of the slightly younger, in their peak players who are, mm-hmm. who are sidelined. And actually, it's a lot of the guys in their 30s who have been available for Chelsea. And that has contributed to a lack of pace at the back, which has been a massive problem for Chelsea under Potter. Koulibaly at the moment is being made to look really, really average and mediocre. And he is a lot better than that, because he's not particularly quick at this point in his career, but normally he has the support system around him, but he's playing with Thiago Silva, who's 38 yep. years old. He doesn't have a great deal of recovery pace. We've already covered that Cucurella isn't all that quick. That's not his game, getting back to cover. Azpilicueta is 33. Jorginho is incredibly slow over the ground. So if he's the guy in front of that back four, he's not providing a lot of protection either in that regard. And then someone like Fofana, a defender who could mask some of this, he does have recovery pace, and I can imagine that is why he was brought in the summer. He plays a couple games and then gets a long-term injury. I think he's out for the season. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying that Potter hasn't made bad decisions. I'm certainly not saying that Chelsea haven't and Todd Boehly haven't made bad decisions, but they have been dealt a rough hand here.
Yeah. Graham, looking at, as we record this, Chelsea will be playing, we're recording this Thursday, they're playing later this afternoon against Fulham. Looking at their prospective lineup for a moment, you've hit it already. It's Azpilicueta at right back, Cucurella at left back, Thiago Silva, Koulibaly in the middle, and then that midfield three of Kovacic, Jorginho, and Dennis Zakaria. Get excited, everybody. A lot of attacking intent there.
Slow.
Like, it's wild that even with the amount of money that has been spent in the past, and then in the summer window combined with the January window, I think they spent over 350 million euros, if not pounds. And I think they've only sold 50 going the other way. So a net spend of negative 300 million to get to this point is sort of shocking. And maybe this, I don't want to move us out of Graham Potter conversation quite yet, but I think that is really interesting the way recruitment has gone, because I think under Thomas Tuchel, there were issues about midfield creativity and then how the midfield functions without N'Golo Kanté. There were questions about who can be that number nine and how do you get the best out of your attacking play. And then there were questions of should they be in a back three? And if so, how do you get the best out of the personnel who can make that happen? All of those questions do sort of remain. So to your initial question to me, Ryan, we've been going for a while. Ryan, you're still there, right?
Allegedly, yeah.
Okay, allegedly, yeah. I think the answer is I don't think things are nearly as dissimilar as I expected them to be when Tuchel was in charge, and that's the Thomas Tuchel who, from what I understand of him, is a fairly prickly persona. I think is a good motivator at times when he has the buy-in, but I think there is a point when players start to lose that faith, lose confidence in him. And it seemed to me a no-brainer of bringing in Graham Potter for the success he had had at Brighton, but also for the kind of individual man management style that I had read about that he seemed to favor. And it seemed to me like if nothing else, you would get a Chelsea team that was just a bit more harmonious, that you had that sort of new manager buy-in, and there's then the ability to kind of get players playing the way you want them to play. And I don't feel like we've really seen that. It's really surprising to me. When we did the big thing on the Clear Lake Todd Boehly takeover, I would say like almost hilariously naive. I will own that one and say like I was like this could be really interesting. They're going to be spending money. He wants to take new approaches. Like I was all about it. And I now think back on that and realize how many red flags there were in that conversation that I was kind of willing to ignore and now see as even bigger red flags than they might have been then.
Well, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, Taylor, let's dig into some of those red flags. We've covered a lot of the on-field issues, injuries and whatnot. Let's see what's going on off the field and how that might have affected this team. Back shortly.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to The Big Thing. Chelsea edition, part 17? Seems like we talk about them a lot on this show, but they are very interesting to talk about. That's no disrespect to them or us. Graham, I led off this show with a quote from Graham Potter, and we can probably talk about the things he said publicly as well. That's an interesting point of discussion. Mm. But what he said about the ownership there, he's implied that it's a rudderless ship, hasn't he? Which is a bold thing to say from a new owner who's brought you in. So I'm not saying he's like passing the buck on this, but he's certainly...
But you're not saying that?
He's not saying that, exactly. It feels like he is... It's not scapegoating, is it? He's pointing at something, isn't he? And he's hinting that all is not well in the front office.
And I think he would be right in that conclusion. I think that is obvious even to outsiders looking at Chelsea this season. The upheaval at Chelsea since last summer has been absolutely gigantic. They've had a change in ownership, obviously, with Roman Abramovich leaving the club, Todd Boehly and the consortium coming in. But then you also have a complete scrubbing of the sporting structure at the club. So Marina Gravskaya and Petr Cech, they leave the club. They were the sporting director, technical director at Chelsea for a number of years. Towards the end, maybe less success with some of the signings, but generally speaking, had been very successful. Particularly Gravskaya was kind of hailed as one of the best sporting directors in the Premier League. But they leave not long after Abramovich is unseated as owner, and Boehly doesn't replace them immediately. In fact, Boehly appointed himself as interim sporting director, a role for which he had no qualifications. And while it might be too early to judge the success or failure of the individual signings that he helped make, there certainly didn't seem to be any strategy in the transfer market at all. And maybe we can talk about the transfers that Chelsea have made a little bit later on. But this is a club experiencing an identity crisis, both on the pitch, but I would say the on-pitch identity crisis is related to what's happening off the pitch. And with Abramovich as the owner, Chelsea were all about getting results as quickly as possible. They would sign fully formed players who could deliver immediately. And there wasn't much succession planning at Chelsea under Abramovich. And in a weird way, it worked because they had money. They could just continually buy players that were at their peak and just keep things rolling over. They went after the best managers. Jose Mourinho, who was the best young manager in Europe at the time, he comes in his second season. They get Conte. They get Tuchel. That was their identity. That was Chelsea's identity, was winning and just spending money to keep winning. Now, you still have Chelsea spending money, but they're spending that money on some of the best young players around at one end of the spectrum. And then at the other end, they're signing 30-year-old Kalidou Koulibaly and paying £8 million to sign Yao Felix on a six-month loan deal. So there's this disconnect between apparent long-term planning, and I'm not sure there is much long-term planning besides just setting the Football Manager search filter to under 21 and then just picking players because it doesn't seem like they have a place in the team at the moment. So you have that on one side, long-term planning, and then the short-termism of just getting players and bodies in the door at Stamford Bridge. So yeah, I can understand why Potter is pointing to a lot of the off-field problems because they have been plentiful.
Graham, forgive me. It sounds like you've almost described the same thing as happening though. They were spending a lot of money on fully mm-hmm. formed players and, you know, overspending. And now, you know, they spent a pretty penny in the summer on many players who are not exactly 21 years old and spending 8 to 10 million on a loan deal for half a season for Yao Felix. Yes, a young player, but still... It doesn't feel like the master plan's changed that much when you look at it like that.
in terms of Chelsea and their youth recruitment, I think it was different in the past. They would get players when they were 14, 15 years old. So Billy Gilmore is a perfect example of that. It was at Rangers until 15, 16, and then he'd go into the Chelsea Youth Academy, and then he'd be there for a few years and then go into the first team. Now they're buying young players at a higher, certainly more expensive price point to go straight into the senior squad without much plan of what's happening with them. I mean, the player whose name I can never pronounce is Chukwuemeka, who came from Aston Villa. He's too expensive. He's too good to go into the development squad, but what's the plan for him in the first team? And he's kind of got some minutes recently just through injuries, but what is the plan for him? That's where I think there's a difference, certainly in terms of the youth development.
One thing, I hear you both. I think is really interesting is the way I've seen some people talk about and write about this Chelsea team. It's very clear that I think people want the narrative to be, because this is a clear and easy narrative, is the idea that this is what happens when oil money goes away. And like, lest we forget, I did this all the time and forgot that like Abramovich is himself essentially a petro state. He's a petro individual, but he is the first of oil money coming in, or like the most prominent of oil money coming in and changing the direction and future of a club. And I think many people have sort of started to write articles that hedge that a little bit of like, oh, this is what happens when now like the money matters. You have to spend more frugally, because to Graham's point, it did used to just be, okay, new manager, spend that money. We'll give that guy, like, we'll buy out Vish Bosch for 20 million and then give somebody else a contract for another 20 million that we'll then buy out. But clearly have been spending an insane amount of money. And so in some ways, that narrative doesn't really work. I hear what you're saying, Graham, about youth development. But I think the difference is just that, at least with Abramovich, it felt like he was so clinical in that this isn't working. New manager comes in. New manager, which three players do you need? We'll buy those three players. Now the team will be good. We'll win. Oh, that's not working anymore. Manager goes away. We buy him out. New manager, who do you need? And I don't think that ruthlessness is there from Todd Boehly yet, at least. But I also think because you don't have that front office the way you used to, you don't have the ability to check some of those spending inclinations. That wasn't meant to be a pun on Petr Cech, but it does work, because I do think Gretzky and Cech had much more say, much more control, much more awareness of how to do business. And so I think the signings themselves, it's not, oh, they don't have money anymore, so they can't bring in those big names. It's just that the signings don't make as much sense because those big names don't really fit. It's like a huge one was Shevchenko being brought in because Abramovich just loved him and wanted him and find a way to make him play, and it didn't work. It's like multiple Shevchenkos are being purchased with the idea that, well, one of them will score goals, and I don't think that has necessarily gone to plan. If I wanted to be generous for a moment, though, to Graham's point about these young players being purchased and what happens next, because they're too good for the academy, but they're not maybe quite at the level where they're ready to play for the Chelsea first team, it does sound like what Clearlake and Todd Boehly have identified is the need to basically purchase a feeder club. And that seems like the model they're going to go for is the Red Bull model of they're looking at different clubs in Europe. I think there was maybe one in France and maybe one in Portugal. I could be wrong. But that they had previous discussions with about basically turning them into Chelsea Junior. And then you can send those players there and they're playing a style that then develops them for the future. By all accounts, that loan structure that Chelsea had forever when they had 45 and 50 players out on loan was really scattershot, because you can't trust all of those clubs to develop those players the way you need them to be developed. And so I think long term, that is what they're aiming for, is buying another club and having that sort of club network. But then again, that speaks to the weirdness of the way they're doing things, which is you're buying all those young players and then you're going to go for the club. Like, it just seems like they're sort of doing things scattershot and hoping that something works.
Well, Taylor, that's a really interesting point. And the same thing about like effectively buying a lot of Shevchenkos. It points to the philosophy in a way, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. And you look at a team like Manchester City, who knew they wanted Pep 7 or 8 years before they got Pep. And there was a plan laid out. And it seems like what's happening at Chelsea is to a certain extent what happened at Man United after Ferguson. By the time you got to Jose Mourinho, you had a squad that was built by three different managers of parts that didn't fit together and of different ages, and didn't have a core philosophy to them, because they had several managers doing different things, if they even had a philosophy at all, which they probably didn't. And maybe what we're seeing with Potter now is the culmination of that. We've got players recruited under different, not managers, but also regimes as well.
Yeah,
and with no clear rationale exactly what's going on there in terms of a philosophy at the very least. So maybe now we're sort of we're hitting the point where that's become an issue.
I think the biggest issue for me, the thing that I find most frustrating, is that what Chelsea keep doing is just making the Saudi ownership group at Newcastle look that much better. Like, they just keep looking like this well-oiled, well-run machine, making smart signings, backing Eddie Howe, having this kind of cohesive structure. That's, I think, slight number one for Chelsea, is that now they're making the Saudis look like they know what they're doing, which is annoying to me. But it is also just this very strange sort of combination of players and managers and front office personnel. And really, like, yes, it's great that Todd Boehly has decided to not go the welcome to Wrexham route of outsourcing transfers to Twitter. But at the same time, like, I'm not sure he's fully gone away from that on occasion. The João Félix one being the most prime example of, get us another guy who'll probably score goals. Like, that'll work. That should work fine, right? He's a name. And I am very confused by that decision to sign him, which probably means it will work out great and I'll look like a fool. But man, does that not seem like the issue this team has right now.
The João Félix signing is quite funny because that transfer was announced on the same day it was announced that Todd Boehly is actually stepping down as sporting director, which is obviously good news. But it was like, just let me sign one last player for no good reason. Okay, João Félix, right, we'll get him in. The João Félix signing doesn't make much sense to me. And it kind of just points to how Chelsea's transfer strategy so far, to an outsider anyway, it kind of looks like they're sheep. They're just following. They're not in the chat about João Félix until Arsenal and Man United are apparently talking about him. Then all of a sudden Chelsea are in the picture. Mudryk has been going to Arsenal. There's been no other club interested in Mudryk. Maybe PSG for a week or so. Arsenal get close to a deal. All of a sudden Chelsea are interested in a deal. That seems like they don't have much of a recruitment department, so they're leaning on the recruitment departments of other clubs to do their scouting for them. And I would say the plus side of this is, the hope for Chelsea is that Boehly's not going to be, they're not going to end up in an Ed Woodward situation, which was the fear when he seemed to be taking on so much responsibility. He is standing aside, and Chelsea have hired 5 senior people to the recruitment department since last summer. And it's worth mentioning that the 2 men at Chelsea now in terms of transfers are Christopher Vivelli, who's the new technical director, and Paul Winstaley, who is director of global talent and transfers. So Vivelli's come from RB Leipzig, and Winstaley came over from Brighton. He worked with Potter before. So that is good news. That is encouraging for Chelsea. That we'll kind of look back at the first 6 months of Todd Boehly's ownership and think, wow, that was a wild time. But from this point on, maybe there will be more of a strategy, certainly a coherent strategy from them in the transfer market.
Lest we forget, by the way, off the field, the executive Tom Glick came in as president of business, which is my favourite title ever.
It's a very Kroll show, good at business sort of business card, isn't it? I hope it's spelled B-I-Z-N-E-S-S.
Yeah. It's very Lego movie.
At least one Z in there.
Yeah, of course.
Z in there. Excuse me.
Todd Boehly, Taylor. Our impressions thus far, and we've talked about him quite a bit already, but do we get the sense he is going to back off and actually let his employees run this thing?
No, not really. I mean, maybe he will, but I think what we've come to know about people with a ton of money is that they like being involved in decisions and they like to be heavily involved on occasion. And I think with Abramovich, that had its negatives, certainly, like the Shevchenko one. There's other examples of that where he just is like, I want this player, we're doing it this way. He's a little bit impatient and he sacks a manager when maybe he shouldn't have. But I think he also then builds a structure, recruits well when it comes to the front office, when it comes to some of those positions, to just make the club function better. And then it's still going to be him involved in the decision making, maybe less of the day to day that seems to have been Granovskaya's like domain. But Todd Boehly thus far strikes me as a person who wants to be involved, who wants to, and not even from a nefarious, I have to make every decision, but he just seems like, yeah, what can I do? How can I help? What can I do to make it better? And I can appreciate that sort of engine, that sort of desire, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to make the smart decisions because of it. And I think if he does continue to be involved, maybe that works well because he's signing off on transfers and buying a club that can be that feeder club and helping develop academy infrastructure. But I think also if it's him thinking, well, what if we sign this guy? Like, who is the Sunderland owner who, like, famously overpaid for Will Grigg, like, after his, like, 19th bid? Like, yeah. I also, there are shades of that when it comes to Todd Boehly, at least to me, a person who has had zero interaction with him, but from an outsider's perspective, also seems like a guy who, if he wants something, is going to go get it, regardless of whether or not that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yao Felix, going back to it for a moment, is a prime example of that. Listening to the way that the Athletic Football Show did an episode about Chelsea, and they were talking about the loan fee that Atleti were demanding, and everybody sort of balking at that one. And then there was this pause where you expected it to be like, but then Chelsea realized they had this going on, and Atleti realized they weren't going to get what they wanted, and so they met in the middle. And the narrative is instead basically, so Atleti wanted a ton of money for a player for a 6-month loan. They wanted his wages covered. Everybody said no. And then a couple of days later, Chelsea came back and said yes. Like, that's much it. Nothing changed. They decided they needed
it. Chelsea have done that a few times already.
Yeah.
So basically with Cucurella, Brighton said 50 million, which was essentially go away. They didn't want to sell Mark Cucurella. They said a number that they didn't think anyone would pay, and Chelsea were like, yeah, sure, actually, here, have 60 million. They did that with Wesley Fofana as well. Leicester City did exactly the same thing. Leicester went 80 million because they didn't want to sell Wesley Fofana. Chelsea went, okay, here you go. 80, yeah. Like, some of the prices they've paid for these players are absolutely incredible. And will surely, you look at Manchester City, they did the same thing with Woodward over a number of years, mm-hmm. and it hamstrung them over a number of years, because you go back to the well, you go back to the transfer market for a player that you need, Benfica, maybe, Enzo Fernandez, Chelsea give you a call, hey, we want one of your players. Okay, we want 120 million euros. If you can't, it's unsustainable, particularly with FFP. So Chelsea have kind of backed themselves into a corner here.
Yeah, and Graham, like, I'm glad that really, like, hit some points, because I think if there's a player that you know is going to make you better, like, maybe Virgil van Dijk is a bad example of this because Liverpool don't get him the first time. But I think we often praise Liverpool for just having that practicality of, this is the guy we need to make our team better. What's he going to cost? That's a lot of money. He's going to make us better. Let's pay it. And I think when that is the exception rather than the rule, that's business. That's modern football. You have to spend an insane amount of money if that's the player that is going to make that difference. But your impression of Chelsea feels accurate. Like, oh, okay, yeah, that's fair. Like, it doesn't seem like it's this sort of like, ah, that's a lot of money, but this is the guy we've wanted. We've scouted him. We know it's going to make us better. We got to pull the trigger here. But with another player, no, you know what? Like, we can find a better value. We can find a better player, or maybe not quite as good a player, but they're going to be 30 million less. Let's do that. It just doesn't seem like there is that debate, that there is that, like, even knowledge of what they actually need to make that team function. It's just, it still feels very much throwing darts at a wall and seeing what happens.
Yeah. It really feels like Atleti saw Chelsea coming, though, to reemphasize that point, not just with the high amount they got for a half-season loan deal. They extended his contract simultaneously, right? So they put another few years on his contract. They're saying, we're going to just increase the value of our asset while getting even more money, loaning it to you for half a season. You'll probably have him score a bunch of goals because we're not using him as effectively as you could. We'll have him back, and then we'll sell him for even more because he's got a longer contract. Yeah, well, we're good at business. You're not.
The one thing on that note, I did see, is it Luis Enrique? I think I saw some reports that he is going to take over Atleti at the end of the season. I don't know if that's true. That feels like a lot of rumor mongering. But if it is the case, then that's an even smarter move from Atleti, because they basically get someone to pay João Félix's wages plus the loan fee on top. And then you get him back for potentially a new manager who will use him more effectively. So you give him that 6 months to either go improve and have some fun, or more likely be like, grass maybe isn't greener. Maybe I want to stay with Atleti because Chelsea did not go well. And so then he goes back and he's happy. It just feels like good business from Atleti and less good from Chelsea.
Indeed. Let's take one more quick break. When we come back, maybe we'll have a little look to the future. What Chelsea can do to turn this around, whether it's in the transfer market or maybe looking elsewhere for another coach. Back
it's short. The transfer market. Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics, and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS. This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to The Big Thing. Taylor Rockwell leaving us on a cliffhanger of it's the transfer market. Do you think there are moves to be made in the next few weeks for Chelsea?
Apparently they are not done. They still want a midfielder. I think they maybe wanted either a wing back, or no, they need a wing back, but I think they might go for a center back instead. Yeah, I think they're going to continue to spend money. I guess the $350 million hasn't been enough. It's wild to look at how much they've spent and where they've spent it, because there are those big name players like Fofana and Gukureya, I guess. I shouldn't laugh at that, but it's like, I don't know. Are those two combined worth $145 million? I don't know. Raheem Sterling is a transfer that I thought would be very smart and work really well, a la Gabriel Jesus or Zinchenko, for $56 million. He is their top scorer, but they haven't scored a ton. And then from there, like Badi Ashile, who's come in from Monaco, he's 38
that's
million euros.
That's a good
euros.
Deal, actually. That's an exception to the rule of Chelsea so
there
far.
We go.
I think that's a good one.
The rule
All right.
of Chelsea.
But Koulibaly costing the same amount and not looking nearly as good is disconcerting. They've already brought in Andre Santos in January and David Datro Fofana, another Fofana from Molde. One gets injured, one comes in. But like Aubameyang for $12 million, and then remember when Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang played for Chelsea? That was odd. It again
he's
continues
back to Barca apparently.
Yeah, apparently. I would say
money
that's probably smart for him.
Allegedly.
There we go. nice allegedly in there, Graham. But yeah, all that to say, it does feel like they're just going to continue to spend money because they still have areas that I think they need to strengthen or should strengthen. So I think in the short term, the solutions will be a couple more players. And I personally think the solution should be stick with Graham Potter. I think giving him not a preseason and bringing him into this situation where you don't have really any leadership or any sort of proven established leadership. You've got a squad that is accumulated over the seasons with different managers that isn't particularly harmonious, that isn't in a good spot when he comes in. And now he has to kind of turn that around. I think sacking him would be a mistake. And I'm kind of confused by the idea that he is a manager that Roman Abramovich would not have gone for. Not because I disagree with it. I get the idea behind it that he doesn't have that pedigree of the managers that Abramovich would go for. But it's not as though Roman Abramovich made the best decisions when it came to managers, because for every Gus Hiddink or Carlo Ancelotti, who was then fired, or Antonio Conte, you've got, remember like Luis Felipe Scolari being a manager, member of VH Boas? Like there are plenty of managers. Who did he, like, was it, I can't even remember if it was Avram Grant who he didn't give the permanent gig to.
I'll just run through them quickly. Yeah. Ranieri, Mourinho, Grant, Scolari, Hiddink, Ancelotti, AVB, De Matteo, Benitez, Mourinho, Hiddink again, Conte, Sarri, Lampard, then Tuchel.
We didn't start the fire.
But like, it's so, first of all, like, you can't tell me that Roberto Di Matteo, when he got that permanent gig, was more established than Graham Potter, because he wasn't. Yes, they won the Champions League, but that in and of itself does not make him a better manager. But I get the idea that Potter would not have been the person that Abramovich would have looked to, but the reality is that's who is there now. That's who was appointed by Clear Lake for the specific reasons of what he did at Brighton and how he made that team successful, but how he has made pretty much every team he has managed so far successful. I think the idea of cutting ties with him to bring in somebody else who will right this ship, I don't see it happening. I don't think it makes sense. And forgive me for going long, but a final point on this would just be, we talked about this in the weekend review, some of those goals that Chelsea gave up in that 4-0 loss are just idiotic individual mistakes. They are players making stupid decisions. Kai Havertz, that handball, what are you doing, man? Like, you know not to do that. You know, and it just felt to me like he was like, oh, we play volleyball now, right? I can just punch that ball away? Cool. Like, to put it all on Graham Potter is, I think, a mistake. Certainly, he bears some of the responsibility here. But it is the players themselves who have failed to live up to their price tags. It is Graham Potter who isn't getting the best out of this team yet. But it's the front office, or lack thereof. It's Clear Lake and the way they've gone about kind of building this team and creating a sense of chemistry that isn't quite there yet. I think lots of people shoulder the blame here. And I think for any one person to have to fall on their sword would be a mistake.
Well, Graham, If Roman Abramovich was still in charge, and let's say Chelsea are in 10th, let's say they finish 10th to 12th in the Premier League, let's say it doesn't pick up from here, he's gone. Even if they finish 8th or 7th, he's gone under Abramovich. It feels insane to say that he should go this season, but, I mean, crazier things have happened at this club.
They certainly have. Todd Boehly, I'm not sure if he's actually spoken publicly about it, but all the reporting is he wants a long-term project, so maybe Potter isn't under a great deal of pressure with his job right now. But every manager and every owner and chairman has a point of no return with a manager where results are just so bad. And I do wonder how long this run goes, but to what point does Chelsea need to get to where Boehly goes, okay, enough's enough. I don't want to sack this manager, but I've got no choice here. And the Chelsea fans, so far, I think they've been open to the idea of Potter, but the last couple of weeks I have spotted a bit of a change in the tide with Potter, particularly with some of his comments to the media.
Yeah,
as Chelsea manager, so he has opened up a little bit more since the World Cup, and he's called, as you said at the top of the show, Ryan, he's called the Chelsea job the most challenging job in the world. He's spoken about a reset. In his words, Chelsea are going through a massive transition. And there was a report only today that he's gathered all the senior players at Chelsea and some of the more experienced guys to hear what they think about the team's struggles. And on one hand, I quite like that. It shows he's listening, he's thinking about the problems Chelsea have and how to solve them. On the other hand, I contrast that to Erik ten Hag and his approach at Manchester United, where, at least to the public, he is certain in his convictions. He knows what he wants Man United to be, and even in a dysfunctional club, so he's in a club that's had questions over their front office and transfers and so on, he's not going to stop at anything to make it happen. Anyone who disagrees or doesn't meet his standards is out the door, even if you're Cristiano Ronaldo. And I'm not necessarily saying that one is the right way, the other is the wrong way. But for Potter, it just adds to the sense that he doesn't have the answers yet. And if you're Chelsea, you're having to place faith in the belief that he is the guy who will find those answers over someone like Luis Enrique, who I think stylistically is probably a better fit for this current squad. Chelsea at the moment have a problem with speed and the pace of their play. Luis Enrique likes his team play a much slower game. They're more possession-based. I think that suits this Chelsea team better. Pochettino, maybe not as good a fit as Luis Enrique, but he's available. He pretty openly wants a Premier League job, I think. Two good alternatives for Chelsea. Like that in itself puts pressure on Potter. And I think the other thing that Chelsea fans they've not liked recently is just some of the comments Potter makes where he's a little bit too nice. Yep. So I know for a fact that some Chelsea fans didn't like when Potter praised Forrest after their draw against Chelsea, because it's not a very big manager thing to do, to praise that, you know, you've just dropped points away to a promoted team. You don't come out and praise them, as ridiculous as that may seem. That is a kind of an unwritten rule. So Chelsea fans want Potter to bare their teeth a little bit more. You look at the managers they've had in the past, Mourinho, Conte, Tuchel. It is a change, not just in the ownership of Chelsea and the way they're playing. It's also just a change in the character of their team, that they have a nice guy like Graham Potter in charge. And we might like Potter for being that nice guy, but it doesn't necessarily mean that Chelsea fans will like him, or that he'll be the right man for Chelsea.
Yeah, I don't like... I've heard that same Nottingham Forest thing, Graham, and the comparisons to David Moyes at Manchester United when he said, like, we aspire to play the type of football that Man City plays. That is an immediate moment for Man United fans of, like, no, like, that's not how this is supposed to work.
Man United were champions as well at that point,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, I think... On the one hand, when David Moyes says something like that, when Graham Potter says something like that, you understand what they're trying to say. But even there, to your point, Graham, there's a way that managers of that caliber will say it. They will say, like, full credit to Nottingham, they deserve the point, but we, and they go into what they, and like, that's it. And to pause and say, like, you got to give them credit for the way they fought, and they, you know, they had this plan, and they, like, I think they're, you can be a little bit too effusive, at which point you're starting to admire them, and I don't think that's what fans would like. But I also think there is a little bit blood in the water, and that would be a worry to me if I were Graham Potter. And I think part of the things he is saying publicly indicates to me he is aware that there is blood in the water. But when you start having the media nitpick those types of statements, I think it shows that they're sensing there could be a vulnerability here. There is maybe something at play. And I would say, why do we know that meeting with the senior players happened? Think about it for a moment, and like, why does the public need to know that? They don't. The only reason you put that out there is because you, Chelsea, are trying to say, look, he's got the senior players on board. Look, the senior players are talking to him. He's asking them for their input. Everything's great, right? Aren't things wonderful? Like, when you pause and look at it, that's just PR. They're just trying to show you that actually everybody's working together. We're all pulling in the same direction. And to your point about Ten Hag, I think you can be pulling in the direction and not have to loudly proclaim it, whereas when you loudly proclaim, yeah, things are great, we're having meetings, it's wonderful, it starts to be like, are things wonderful, though? Because I feel like when things are wonderful, you don't loudly say, things are wonderful. You just enjoy how things are.
Indeed. And I'm enjoying how this conversation has gone, gents. We've big-thinged once again, wonderfully, once again ruminating on South West London's dysfunctional yet very rich Premier League proponents. Taylor Rockwell, thank you very much for all your contributions today. You will not be fired this episode.
Hey, that's positive.
Graham, you're under review.
I mean, I guess one Graham has to be fired.
Oh, Graham, we have an update. You were under review, but now they've extended your contract by 70 million?
Oh, wow. Thanks, Todd.
You're going on a 20 million half-season loan to the Football Ramble. Congratulations, Graham.
Ideal. Sounds great. When do I leave?
Just kidding. Listener, thank you very much for joining us. Patreon.com/Total Soccer Show if you want to continue the conversation on our Discord. It's a lot of fun. But for now, thank you again for listening. We'll catch you later. Bye!